Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
We're counting down to the end of the Open House year on December 8, and we're in the midst of a special feature we're calling Lee's Top 10, the best of the best of the best interviews of the last 2.5 years plus on Open House. It's been a really tough call, narrowing all the wonderful conversations and stories we've brought you on Open House to just 10. One that just had to make this list is Lindy Chamberlain-Creighton, who took us through her story of the last 33 years from when her baby daughter Azaria was taken by a dingo at Ayers Rock, now Uluru. You must hear what she says about forgiveness. And if any Australian has lots to forgive, it's this woman, Lindy Chamberlain-Creighton.
I had a 6-year-old, a 4-year-old. I was pregnant, keeping my fingers crossed that I was going to have a daughter at last.
And you had your girl.
We did. We had a girl.
Yeah. You're a pastor's wife, and in fact a pastor's daughter. Tell us about that side of your life.
Busy, I guess. All sorts of things. Part of citizens' advice bureaus and assessing for welfare and cooking demonstrations and counselling, typing up sermons and feeding people and organising husbands and all those sorts of things that just naturally fall into the wife secretary help meet that belong to a clergyman.
Yeah. And the family takes off for the long trip to Ayers Rock and then that memorable night. Can I ask you what first aroused your alarm?
Michael. He thought he'd heard her cry. I was sure she hadn't. I was sure she was settled for the night. Then Sally Lowe and Aidan all said, yeah, she cried. So I thought, oh, well, I'll pacify them, go back and have a look. Then all hell broke loose.
Yeah. The eyewitnesses around you on that night were very supportive. There's no doubt of what had happened.
Well, so were the police and the rangers and most people. We had no idea there was any dissension until several days later. However, the Lowes, who they were so upset, they packed up and went and tried to find a motel room, and sitting in the bar, they just couldn't believe the talk that they heard, that maybe it was some sort of hoax or, you know, and it got worse from there.
Yes.
And they were just gobsmacked that anybody could say that.
Once the media got a hold of this, one commentator wrote that your situation was a media dream. It had all the elements: mystery, instinctive fears, motherhood, femininity, family, religion, politics and tourism, court and forensic drama. What do you think it was that drove the events that so comprehensively turned against you?
It's a little bit of everything.
Including human nature?
Human nature is at the bottom of everything, isn't it? Greed and selfishness make us do all sorts of things. As ordinary human beings, we should be looking out for one another, but we seem to prefer to look out for ourselves.
How shocked were you in the midst of what you've called a fiasco, that you found yourself in the middle of this? And I want to keep on remembering that your 9-week-old child has been taken from you.
The thought that somebody actually has the audacity to accuse you of doing something to a child that she loved is just mind-boggling. On the other hand, I've always had the personality that you look at the facts and get on with them as quickly as possible. My dad taught me to always try and look at the other person's point of view, try and understand them from that point of view. And it was very, very difficult for me to understand what had gone wrong, because I knew the rangers were supportive. I knew the police were supportive. And all of a sudden, those police disappeared, other police appeared, totally different attitude, and yet they'd never been to the Rock. We'd never had any contact with them before. And rumours that we were hearing, it was like, where did that come from?
Yeah.
Why are they doing this? And why all of a sudden are they trying to make me look guilty? What are they afraid of that's going to come out?
And yet, as far as everyone saw on the TV each night, you both appeared calm, even serene about it all.
I wouldn't say that. And if you look back at the raw footage, you would see neither, or knew our personalities before that, you would see neither of us were calm or serene or complacent about it. It was just fashionable at that stage to edit every time we got upset. Yeah. The public wanted to know everything, but they didn't want to be upset. So the public was demanding, don't upset us. So it was a standard thing for the media to say, well, we get all these letters if we upset them and show you crying. So every time you cry, we edit it out. You know, my friends would say to me, you'd been crying before that interview. We could tell by your eyes. Or you're too detached. You're, you know, looking at the facts and detaching yourself to them, where the media would say, you know, well, look, hard-faced bitch, she's not affected, because they didn't know my personality. And it was in the early days of when Rupert Murdoch had just taken over a lot of the press. And so in order to keep people watching the news, like a swing news, make you look innocent one day, guilty the next. And so people began to watch the news as a serial.
And put Lindy, the name Lindy, on the front page and sell more papers or magazines.
Yeah, they used to tell me if my name was on the front, they had to print triple as a minimum.
So if what we're seeing was a very edited version of what was going on in your lives, what was the reality of how you were both coping?
Well, I used to look at the television news every night after court to see what that woman was doing, because it didn't bear much resemblance to my life. It was like watching somebody else, particularly when you saw reporters staggering down. We'd go down to have dinner at night at maybe 6:30, 7 o'clock early, and they'd be so drunk they weren't walking in a straight line. They were literally propping themselves up, just going to put my story in. Hardly keep your speech audible. You're slurring it, you don't know what you're saying, but you're putting in today's news story, and I have to live with the result.
So how were you both coping then, in reality?
I was going second by second. That's where support is very important, and the support we had from my parents and from Stuart Tipple was phenomenal.
And a lot of other Australians.
There were a huge number of people. You know, people say, oh, what's prayer? Does it work? Whatever. By the time I was in prison, and I can remember at times when you could literally feel the prayers surrounding you, almost like you were being wrapped in blankets.
How deeply did you dig into your faith as this, in your words, fiasco, this frenzy, took on a life of its own?
Just when I saw into the tent, I knew in that split second, it is God or I can't handle it. You know, I can't go through this. I have got to have something other than myself.
Was there ever a cry to God, what are you doing, or what are you allowing to happen in my life?
Not really. I remember saying once, I don't know why this has happened. I don't understand whether I need to learn something, or whether somebody else needs to learn something, or what your reason for it. I know one day you'll show me the reason, but in the meantime, as long as you're with me, I can go through this. And I also remember saying that just before the verdict came down at the trial, they'd been waiting and waiting and waiting, and I finally prayed that instead of let me go home to the kids, it's like, well, Lord, you know better than me, so your will. And they knocked on the door and said, the jury's back. And it was like, I just knew that I wasn't going home. But I was at peace with it, because I'd said to God, I'll go if you babysit the kids.
On Open House, we're with Lindy Chamberlain Creighton. Lindy, you mentioned it just before the break. As the court case begins, you're charged with murder, and by this time you've already been through a great deal. How fearful were you as that court case went on?
I think Moy should jump back to the second inquest. That was a very, very difficult time for me. I remember one time in particular just about hyperventilating during that time because it struck me they were going to send me to prison. There were a number of times then I just had to pray second by second and say, you just have to get through this moment, because it was so overwhelming. You just can't, I can't go through this. But with God beside you, you can say, I can go through this because he can see the end of this. Somewhere along the line, there is an end. The judge summed up for acquittal. I can remember his face shed. He went white when he read what the jury had done. We thought all the way through we had every point pegged.
And on that night, when the jail doors closed behind you, can you describe what I imagine is the roller coaster of emotions that you're feeling?
Look, I was so flat by then. I was just absolutely drained physically. I was so tired I could hardly keep awake. I went on early lockup. I just was thinking, I can't believe this. More worrying about how the boys were going to be told, because I'd talked to them that morning. And yeah, and going to pray and realising there's just a big blank hole there, and trying to think of something to say, and in the end saying, oh, you pray for me, God, I can't do this. And then I felt so peaceful. Next thing I knew, it was morning. I'd had a good sleep. I woke up, felt like somebody was looking at me, and sat up and out my window outside the fence that was the dingo.
Oh, really?
I thought, you wretch, oh, you're out there and really? I'm in here. I bet the devil put you right there to discourage me while he's not going to do it. Whatever happens, I know I'm here now for some time, and the end of this is in God's hands. And I always had the feeling that there was an end, that I wasn't going to be there for life.
You've been able to speak quite openly and fully about what that experience was like in jail. What was it initially like for you?
Different to what I thought it would be. I'd been prison visiting in Tasmania, and I'd been to Pentridge in Melbourne and things like that, but it's very different from a visitor's side to the other side.
Yeah.
One of the things I often used to think when we're out in the yard working, there was just this cyclone wire fence between us and people walking along the road and cars, and you think they might as well be in another universe. There's that bubble that you're in that you can't get through.
You went in with hard labour. I've always wondered what that constituted, what that amounted to.
Anything they asked you to do. Some of it was just petty stupidity, and other stuff was hard. We had whippersnippers, which we could do all the edges, but that was too quick. So they got us, and we had buffalo and cooch.
In the tropical climate of Darwin.
Yes. So they got us blunt scissors to cut the edges with instead, and that really used to give you blisters. And it took hours, but that was the whole thing, sit in the sun in for hours. But then we did other things, like we did a storm drain with big rocks and cement. But we didn't have any cement trowels or work gloves. You did it with your bare hands. So cementing with bare hands used as trowels is not much fun. Scrubbing down toilets that had drunk officers in the night before. One particular time I was given a toothbrush to scrub everything out with, so it took hours, and then I was yelled at because it took hours.
And you went into jail pregnant with Kalia.
Yeah.
And gave birth in custody.
And then got out for 5 months because, to quote one of them, that's just to put the kid somewhere.
Did you have protectors in jail? Did you have enemies in jail because of who you were?
Once or twice I was a bit worried. We had one girl in there with a mental problem and she was violent and she liked to do things behind your back. So when she walked, you know, down the table, you would surreptitiously watch out of the corner of your eye till she got one way and then sort of turn the other so that you were watching as much as possible. You know, most of the time when there's no access to drugs and there's no access to alcohol, a lot of the propensity for misbehaviour disappears. So, yeah, it's not fun, and at times you have to really tread lightly.
Yes, yeah.
Some that were a real problem, you know, the girls would come to me and say, well, you're the oldest one in here, make her behave, you know, we'll leave her up to you. You do your best to gently do a bit of counselling and mothering and whatever to calm them down and say, look, you can play up and we'll all pay for it, or you can try and work in with everybody regardless of what you did. It stays at the gate and now we have to work together.
You and Michael divorced in 1991, 5 years after your release from jail, but that had been unravelling for quite some time.
Yes, I think that the case held us together a lot longer, and I had been hoping that that would fix some problems and that we could put it behind us and go on from there, but it actually exacerbated some of the problems. And I remember Carlia saying, I was so angry when you and Dad split and all I wanted was for you to get back together. And she said this quite some time later, but she said once it had happened, then she realised that both of us were so much happier apart, and so was she.
And the next year after your divorce, you meet Rick, and meeting him on a speaking tour of the US. So he'd obviously known about your life here.
I had been speaking over there the year before and the divorce was going through and I hadn't set eyes on him or met him or anything else. However, he had signed petitions in the 80s when he lived in Loma Linda and there were some going around there. And he'd even attempted to hear Michael and I speak. He'd always wondered why he never found anyone. And then he said he knew it was almost like someone said to him, now here's your reason for everything you've been through in your life, so that you were prepared for what these kids and her have gone through, because you can understand it. And friends say to us now, well, we gave it a year or two at the most. And here it was 20 years last year and going stronger than ever.
One of the most powerful and probably for many puzzling aspects of your whole story is how you've been able to forgive everybody. The lawyers, the media, the police, the NT government.
That's easy when you realise what forgiveness is and how to go about it. And most people always think forgiveness is for the other guy. And it isn't for the other guy. Forgiveness is actually very selfish. It's you telling yourself, I don't have to bear their responsibility. I don't have to be responsible for what they've done that's nasty. I don't have to be responsible for their punishment. That's theirs. I can hand all that hurt and nastiness back to them. Get that right out of my life. I can take back my mind, not let myself be screwed up by all this. I can give myself permission to move forwards. And it is all right to be alive. It's all right to go ahead. I am not giving them permission to do this again. I am not saying what they said is all right. I'm choosing to move forwards. I'm handing it all back to them, and now they're responsible for it. Now, if they want to deal with it in their life and realize they're wrong and done something and need forgiveness for it, then it's up to them to go to the person and say, I was wrong, I did this. And then I'm very happy to say to them, well, I've forgiven it. I've moved on. It's okay. Now you just work it out between you and God.
Can be a tough thing to do, though.
It can be a tough thing to do. And sometimes you think, oh, I'd really like to give you a smack. And then you think, hey, you know, why am I thinking that? You know, I'm not responsible for them. And I've often said in my talks, God is far more inventive in his punishments yes. than I could ever be.
Yeah.
And we are all responsible for all our choices and decisions, good and bad. And one day we will have to answer to him. Sometimes we get a little bit of that punishment down here, I'm sure, for doing the wrong thing, especially when Dad gets out the strap. But that is God's prerogative. He's the ultimate judge. And it's just like inviting somebody who hates you to come live in your house. If you consistently decide to hold a grudge, they are living in your head. And by forgiving, you take your head back over and say, this is mine. You will leave.
And if anyone can know the reality of that, it is you, Lindy Chamberlain-Creighton. As I said, just on a year ago, the NT coroner at last officially declared that Azaria was taken by a dingo. And in a very powerful moment in the court, she said that she was so sorry for your loss. What was that moment like for you?
I just thought to myself, you've had a loss too, somewhere not too far away. When I say not too far away, you know, you can get over something, but then something will trigger it and it'll come back, but you get over it quicker the next time. Somewhere she's had some type of loss. That doesn't necessarily mean that it was a death. There's many types of loss in our lives, from loss of jobs to divorces to all those things. But she understood what loss was. I knew she meant it. You could feel the fact that she understood, whereas some people are, I'm sorry for your loss, and you think, yeah, you learnt that phrase in a book, because you know it means absolutely nothing because they've got no concept of what a real loss is. And I guess that to me was probably as important as the verdict. And it's also the reason why I refuse to ask the Northern Territory for an apology, because if you force an apology, you know it doesn't mean a thing. But when it's voluntarily given, like she gave hers, then it means something.
Are you hopeful for an apology?
I don't give it much thought at all. If it's like the Aboriginals, I'll be dead and gone.
But it'd be nice, wouldn't it?
Look, there's still men in power up there saying, yes, I know all the evidence gone, but I know things and I know she's guilty. So I don't think that's going to happen. One would be very happy if they did apologise, but I'm not going to hold my breath.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.